Good morning. Welcome to the Monadnock Summer Lyceum. My name is Jill Schaefer Hammond, and I am the moderator for this morning's program. Since 1828, the Monadnock Summer Lyceum has been bringing outstanding world-class speakers to the Monadnock region to serve as a catalyst to inform, engage, and inspire an active citizenry on local, national, and global issues. The Monadnock Summer Lyceum is held in the historic Unitarian Universalist Church in downtown Peterborough, New Hampshire, at 11 o'clock on summer Sunday mornings. We invite our New Hampshire Public Radio audience to attend these programs and to meet our speakers at the reception following the program. After the talk, I will read questions from our live audience. James Gustav Gus Speth, born in South Carolina, graduated from Yale University in 1964. He attended Oxford as a Rhodes Scholar and returned to Yale Law School. Serving as Eugene McCarthy's campaign coordinator for his home state in 1968 convinced Gus that a life in South Carolina politics was not for him. Following law school, seeking to elude the clutches of large firm corporate law, he hit on the idea of a public interest law firm for the environment. He and others co-founded the Natural Resources Defense Council in 1970. Subsequently, he served on President Jimmy Carter's Council on Environmental Quality and taught law at Georgetown University. In 1984, he founded the World Resources Institute, a Washington, D.C. environmental think tank, serving as its president until 1993. After a stint on the Clinton transition team, he served as administrator for the United Nations Development Program until 1999. He returned to Yale, where he served as dean of the School of Forestry and Environmental Law, retiring in 2009. Gus is now a professor of law at Vermont Law School and is a distinguished senior fellow with Demos and with the United Nations Foundation. His last book was The Bridge at the Edge of the World, Capitalism, the Environment, and Crossing from Crisis to Sustainability. His next one, Shipping Now, is America the Possible, a Manifest for a New Economy. Ralph Waldo Emerson, so the story goes, visited his friend Henry David Thoreau in jail when Thoreau was arrested for protesting and not paying certain taxes. "Henry, what are you doing in there?" Thoreau replied, "Waldo, the question is, what are you doing out there?" A year ago, Gus Speth, one of many arrested for protesting the tar sands pipeline, issued a challenge similar to Thoreau's. "We, the prisoners being held in the central cell block of the DC jail, need company, and we encourage the continuation of the protest against the tar sands pipeline. Help us stop this disastrous proposal." Now he will explain what needs to be done. Ladies and gentlemen, this morning's Lyceum speaker, Gus Speth.
Well, what a wonderful opportunity, and thank you so much, Jill, for that introduction. All those groups that she mentioned have done better after I left them. This is really an extraordinary opportunity, and to be mounted here in this imposing pulpit is a thrill all to itself. I will try to stay within my time limit. I have my watch. I was giving a talk at Yale one time, and I didn't have it, and I ran badly over. And I apologized to the students, but one of them stood up and said, "It's okay, Dean Speth, there's a calendar on the wall behind you." It's great to see some old friends here, and take a second to dedicate these remarks to a friend of mine who's also in the audience, Rogers McCullough. Delighted to have him with us today. Let me just mention that this new book will soon be available in the bookstores. It's America the Possible Manifesto for a New Economy. And much of what I will have to say today is based on this new book. So I hope you'll have a chance to take a look at it. So let me begin. do you want the good news or the bad news first? Well, I won't put you on the spot. Let me begin with the bad news. If we look at 30 measures of how well our country is doing across a broad front of education, health, environment, security of our people, everything, measures of national well-being, what we find is that among a sample of the 20 leading industrial democracies, America is now at the bottom on all 30 indicators. If we're not at the dead bottom, which we are in most cases, we are very near the bottom, next to the bottom. And that's not just bad news, friends, that's really bad news. But here's the good news. I believe an attractive and very pleasant and successful America is still within our power to realize by mid-century. In this America of the possible, as I call it, our country will have rejoined the leading nations in realizing social justice and well-being, in building peace and real global security, in sustaining our planet's environment, both domestically and globally. We will have reclaimed our democracy from what was once quite properly called the moneyed interests. We will have seen a deep transformation in our country's dominant values and culture, leaving today's materialism and excessive individualism, our anthropocentrism, and our contemporocentrism far behind. And we will have realized a new American dream in everyday life, an America where the pursuit of happiness is sought not in more getting and spending, but in the growth of real human solidarity, real democracy, in devotion to the public good, where the average American is empowered to achieve his or her human potential, and where the virtues of simple living, community self-reliance, good fellowship, and respect for nature predominate. In this America of the possible, we will also have avoided a rather long list of potential calamities looming on the horizon. Calamities like severe climate disruption that could, if unaddressed, become so overwhelming that the struggle to cope with them would monopolize the resources of time and energy and money and effectively prevent us from realizing the wonderful future that could still be ours. But we must act now on these looming issues like climate change. Now, that's all very nice, you might be thinking, but how in the world do we get there? How do we get to America of the possible? And I will endeavor in this lecture to begin, at least, to chart the course to America of the possible, the course from today's decline to tomorrow's rebirth. The journey to America of the possible begins, I think, when Americans have come to, enough Americans at least, have come to the following three conclusions. The first conclusion is that something is profoundly wrong with our overall system of political economy, the operating system on which our country now runs. That system is just routinely generating terrible results in the sense that it's failing us socially, economically, environmentally, and politically. And when big problems like those 30 issues on where we're near the bottom or at the bottom emerge across the entire spectrum of national life, it can't be due to small reasons. We have these encompassing problems because of fundamental flaws in our economic and political system. So the second conclusion follows from this first, and it is the imperative of system change, of building a new political economy, a new operating system. Progressive causes in America today all confront the challenge of trying to make progress within this system of political economy, a system that cares profoundly about profit and growth and power, but cares about society and the natural world, mainly when it's required by law to do so. So it's up to us as citizens to inject values of justice and fairness and sustainability and peace into this otherwise uncaring system. And government is the primary vehicle we have for doing this. Typically, we attempt to do it by working within the system to promote needed reforms. But I believe in my own experience is that it's now abundantly clear that these reformist approaches are not succeeding. And to deal successfully with all the challenges America now faces, we've got to complement reform and complement working within the system with at least equal efforts aimed at transformative change in the system itself. In short, we need to build a new political economy, a new operating system that routinely delivers good results for people and planet. And the third conclusion, or realization, is that contrary to what one most frequently hears, an attractive, viable, and plausible alternative to the current system does indeed exist. We certainly don't yet understand all the details or dimensions of how this system will look and how it will operate, but we do know enough to have confidence that something much better can be built, and we know enough to start building it. And in particular, we know that at the core of this new operating system must be a new economic paradigm. And to put it briefly, in this new economic paradigm, the economy is designed to sustain people and place and planet, and not maximize profit and production and power. So I think these are the three fundamental conclusions from which the work of system change will move forward. They're certainly not the conventional wisdom today, are they? But more and more people are coming to these three conclusions. And from the vantage point that they provide, we can see how the dynamics of system change might come into play. So consider these several possibilities. As conditions in our country continue to decline across a wide front, or at best, fester as they are, ever larger numbers of Americans lose faith in the system and its ability to deliver on the values it proclaims. And the system itself steadily loses legitimacy, leading to, in effect, a crisis of legitimacy. And we don't have to predict that many people will begin looking for and demanding something better than what we have today. It's already happening. Meanwhile, traditional crises, both in the economy and in the environment, will grow more numerous and more fearsome. And our political economy, having lost resilience and coping capacity, becomes highly vulnerable to these additional crises, and they further undermine the system and open the door for major change. Meanwhile, progressives of all stripes coalesce and find their voice and their common strength, and together they present a common vision of a new American dream, and they also pioneer the development of a powerful set of new ideas and proposals in policy, confirming that a path to a better world does indeed exist. And people and groups plant the seeds of change through a host of alternative arrangements, principally at the local level across our country. We already see the proliferation of innovative models of local living economies, sustainable communities, transition towns, as well as innovative business models, including social enterprises and for-benefit and worker-owned businesses that prioritize the community and the environment over profit and growth. These initiatives provide inspirational models of how things might work in a new political economy devoted to sustaining human and natural communities. And these developments inspire a contagious proliferation across the country. Demonstrations and protests also multiply as more and more people join in the famous cri de coeur from the film Network, which certainly dates some of us, I'm mad as hell and I'm not going to take it anymore. The protests swell to become a powerful national and international movement for transformation. And finally, sensing the direction in which things are moving, the wiser and more responsible among our leaders rise to the occasion, support the growing movement for change, and frame a compelling story or narrative that draws on the best of the American tradition and points the way to the America that can be. And as a result, the movement for change broadens dramatically. Well, we certainly don't know exactly how these and other forces will emerge and interact in the future, but we do know this, that pleas for immediate amelioration on issues like jobs and tax justice and climate will at best be met with proposals for modest accommodation and half measures, and that the struggle for deep systemic change is going to be met with fierce opposition and determined resistance. So I think an all-important conclusion emerges, namely this, that the prospects for real change will depend mightily on the state of our democracy at the time and the power of the social and political movement that we build. It's simply unimaginable that American politics, as we know it today, will deliver the major changes that we desperately need. Even most of the proposals for modest reforms offered by progressives in Washington today will not be possible without a new politics in America. So political reform and building a new progressive movement in America must be priority number one. And above all else, we must build a new democratic reality, a government truly of, by, and for the people. The story of our political decline has been told well and often enough. Important to that story is the way that the political decline in America, has moved in parallel with the rise of economic inequality and the influence of money in politics. We have seen the emergence, in fact, of a vicious circle. Growing income disparities shift political power to the rich, and that shift in turn reduces the prospect of doing something about the growing disparities. If plutocracy exists, when the wealthy have a greatly disproportionate influence on government, and if corporatocracy is a political state where large corporations have massive power over government, America is now teetering on the verge of a full-blown plutocracy and corporatocracy in substance, if not in form. Because of these great concentrations of wealth and power, reform certainly faces formidable obstacles. Yet the very difficulty of political reform underscores the need for it. As Michael Waldman, the director of one of the key reform groups, the Brennan Center for Justice at New York University, has said, progressives have to grapple with this central truth. We can't solve the country's problems if we don't fix the systems of democracy. So nothing, as I've said, is more important in America today than building a new politics through a unified pro-democracy movement aimed at real citizen sovereignty. The antidote to creeping corporatocracy and plutocracy in America is a strong, muscular democracy in America. So what then should be the specific goals of a pro-democracy political reform in our country today? I'm going to give you a list of 10, probably leaving out something important. First, we need to both expand and protect the process of voting itself. Throughout most of the advanced democracies of the world, voter registration is the default position. If you're 18, you get registered automatically. And once registered, voting can be made easier by a number of ways. Early voting should be extended. Election day should be made a national holiday. Ballots should be made simpler, voting less confusing, and campaigns to discourage and suppress voting through intimidation and deceptive practices should be prohibited and penalized. A National Elections Commission should be charged with providing for election administration and monitoring that's impartial and well-trained and managed by well-trained election officials. And it's very sad, indeed tragic, to see the ongoing efforts today to restrict access to the ballot by having voter ID requirements and similar things, which promise, if they succeed, to disenfranchise millions of our people. Secondly, we need a constitutional amendment to provide for the direct popular election of the president. But as long as that remains a bridge too far, state legislatures should agree to assign all of the state's electoral votes to the candidate winning the national popular vote, but only if and when states holding at least 270 electoral votes, the number needed to win the presidency in the Electoral College, have enacted similar commitments. Well, thus far, 9 states have entered into this pledge through their legislatures, and they together accumulate half of the electoral votes needed to have the president in our country elected by popular vote. Ingenious scheme. Third, we need to reform our current system of primaries. There are many possibilities here, of course, but a key goal is to broaden participation in primaries beyond each party's hard core. And one way to do that is to have structured open primaries where registered independents can vote in either party's primary, which I believe is what you have in New Hampshire. Fourth reform, partisan gerrymandering of congressional districts should simply be stopped. District lines should be drawn by independent, nonpartisan commissions. Fifth, we need to break the two-party duopoly. To do that, we need a process for voting that will encourage third parties without making them spoilers. We'll ensure that every vote counts in the end result and is not wasted. And we'll ensure that winners have the support of the majority of voters. Well, there are two ways to do that. One is instant runoff voting. It's a process where voters rank their preferences among the candidates, and low-scoring candidates, often third parties, are eliminated in the vote counting because they're at the bottom, and their voters' second choices are added to those that remain until one candidate has a majority. Even more attractive is fusion voting, which allows a minority party, a third party, to list as its candidate on the ballot the candidate of another party. Fusion voting thus allows third parties to bargain with the major parties for the best representation it can get. Vermont has fusion voting. New York has fusion voting. Most states, the parties got together and outlawed it. But that can be undone. Sixth, the Senate needs a host of reforms, obviously, including abolishing the current practice under Rule 22 on filibusters. And given the way filibusters are now managed, senators representing, get this, a mere 11% of the U.S. population can exercise effective control over legislation, at least in theory. Of course, that math requires that the senators from Wyoming and Vermont vote together, which is seldom seen today. The seventh, the most important pro-democracy reform is to undermine the power of money in our elections and in our lobbying. Consider this news report from the future, Dateline 2020. A funny thing happened on the way to plutocracy. Just when it seemed that big money donors were on the verge of a final takeover of American politics, and that post-Watergate efforts aimed at reform were dying a death of 1,000 cuts, including a series of major ones inflicted by the Supreme Court, pro-democracy advocates changed tack, found a new way forward, and saved American elections. The key to their success was a shift in emphasis to campaign finance reform based on an ingenious combination of small donor contributions and public funding of elections. Nothing less, really, than the democratization of campaign finance itself. As a major report urged way back in 2010, instead of focusing on attempts to further restrict the wealthy few, the new approach seeks to focus on activating the many. This new approach, supplemented by related efforts to make money less important, had its first big success in the 2016 presidential race and has led to the widely admired system we take for granted today. Well, fanciful? I hope not. I think not. The Fair Elections Now Act, introduced in Congress in April 2011, embodies this approach for congressional elections. There's a parallel effort being done to have this enacted for presidential elections, and it has many supporters in the House and the Senate, almost all of them Democrats, I'm sad to say. But several states have used this fair election approach with good results. All of us now have a huge stake in the success of such an alternative approach. Consider a continuation of current trends, which can aptly be described as an orgy of promiscuous embraces between money and power. The longtime New York Times reporter Linda Greenhouse puts it, "Taken as a whole," she writes, "the campaign finance picture is beyond dreary." Or as Michael Waldman of the Brennan Center said, "Our campaign finance system is arguably the worst in the Western world." Eighth, major changes should be pursued in addressing the many problems created by the Supreme Court's campaign finance decisions, including Citizens United, which opened the floodgates to unrestricted campaign spending by corporations and unions themselves. Amending the Constitution is what's needed. It's impressive the actions that are underway today through Move to Amend and other efforts. And in the process, we need to deprive corporations of constitutional personhood. In the meantime, Congress should require disclosure of the sources of all campaign spending, independent or otherwise. There are two other attractive ideas for regulation. One would require that corporate boards, so even the shareholders themselves, approve all campaign spending initiatives. After all, the corporate managers making those decisions are not spending their own personal money, which they already know how to do well. They're spending the corporation's money, the shareholders' money. A second regulation would truly enforce the requirement that the so-called independent committees and independent expenditures are actually independent and not coordinated or linked in any way with the candidate that they may be supporting indirectly. And of course, the court could just simply reverse itself if a new justice replacing one of those in the 5-member majority were appointed. A ninth area, candidate access to the media should be enhanced and the power of money thus reduced by ensuring that all media carriers and service providers offer full access to political speech at rates offered to the most favored commercial customers, and by requiring that broadcasters provide candidates with a minimum of free airtime as a condition of receiving their federal licenses. Tenth and finally, of course, reforms can't stop with the electoral process itself. Elections happen, and then there's the morning after. Corporations today, a lot of people don't understand this, corporations today spend vastly more on lobbying and influence peddling than on elections. Much needs to be done to tighten up the regulation of lobbying. There should be a ban on registered lobbyists engaging in campaign fundraising. No contributions to campaigns from lobbyists, no lobbyist bundling of multiple contributions, and no other form of lobbyist fundraising for federal candidates. Connecticut has enacted such a ban on the practice that's referred to as pay-to-play. In 2005, it's been upheld in the courts. Congressional staff should be further professionalized and enlarged and paid better in order to reduce the current great dependence own lobbyist information and analysis. And the office is serving the Congress, like the Congressional Research Service and the General Accountability Office, should be strengthened for the same reasons, so that the offices of the congressmen are not so dependent on lobbyist information. Appropriate restrictions should be placed on the lobbying activities of large government contractors. Stricter revolving door provisions should be adopted. And importantly, as an extension of federal laws requiring disclosure of lobbying expenditures, organizations should also be required to disclose other expenditures when they launch major issue campaigns aimed at affecting federal legislation. Also, the sponsors and funders of public issue ads should be required to be identified in those ads, along with an announcement like those in today's campaign ads approving and taking responsibility for the contents. Well, beyond these changes that I've listed in these 10, there are other things that need to be done to strengthen journalism in our country and transparency in government, to restore disinterest to the courts, to rebuild the large membership organizations that can magnify the strength of otherwise isolated voters, and to build the competency and rebuild the competency of our oft-maligned and now depleted civil service. So when you think about this agenda of political reform, the things that beg for change in our political system, it's easy, in fact, to see why so little of what is important actually gets accomplished in Washington in particular. So a pro-democracy agenda like the one just described has got to move to top priority and draw support from Americans across the whole political spectrum, or at least the widest possible portion of it. So now we have arrived at the last question. How do we begin to drive real change in our politics and in our public policy? And the short answer is that we need to build a powerful pro-democracy political movement in our country to drive these changes. None of the measures our country needs is likely to get very far today without a vigorous popular movement that we don't now have, but which may, in fact, gather real force and real strength when all of the crazy things that are happening in this election this year are absorbed come, say, December. Successful movements of the type I'm calling for serious change are launched in protest against key features of the established order. They demand real change. And here one is reminded of the famous statement of Frederick Douglass in 1857 about the challenge of slavery. Frederick Douglass said, "If there is no struggle, there is no progress. Those who profess to favor freedom and yet deprecate agitation are men who want crops without plowing the ground. They want rain without thunder and lightning. They want the ocean without the awful roar of its many waters. The struggle may be a moral one, or it may be a physical one, or it may be both moral and physical, but it must be a struggle. Power concedes nothing without a demand it never did and never will. If we hope to succeed, then our movement for change must capture the spirit of Frederick Douglass." So how would such a movement look, and how do we build it? Well, here's some guideposts to consider. All together now, what doesn't exist and what must now be built with urgency is a unified progressive community. When I was dean at Yale's Environment School, I was fortunate to have some very bright and thoughtful students spend a lot of time when they should have been studying, trying to understand why progressives were losing across such a broad front. And their research revealed a lot that conservatives had done that progressives had not done. In the end, they concluded that the progressives in our country suffered from a strategic deficit disorder. They stated the matter plainly. Our investigation of the last 30 years indicates that elites within the progressive movement have failed to develop comprehensive strategies to gain influence and lasting power in American politics. No unified progressive identity has been developed, nor have there been any concerted efforts to institutionalize coordination among various progressive groups. They have proven weak at engaging new constituencies, uninterested in creating any kind of larger movement than a single campaign, and reluctant to adapt to quickly changing political context. In addition, the students went on, modern progressive movement has lacked vision. Its think tanks have been slow to identify the core values for which they stand, and even slower to communicate them to the public. Clearly, the silos now separating almost all of the progressive communities have got to be breached. And to succeed, there's got to be a fusion of progressive causes, the forging of a common agenda, the building of a mighty force on the ground at the grassroots. And I think this progressive fusion is absolutely essential. Progressives of all stripes have got to come together to build a true community of outlook and interest and engagement by forging a common vision, a common agenda, a common platform, and the organizational infrastructure to strengthen the progressive movement on an ongoing basis. In the end, all the progressive communities face the same reality. We're trying to inject values of environment and society and peace and justice and sustainability into a system where it's very hard to inject those values. And our best hope for real change is a fusion of all those concerned about environment and social justice and true democracy and peace into one powerful progressive force. We have to recognize that we are all communities of shared fate. We will rise or fall together, so we better get together. Well, the good news is that some progress has been made on this front. There are now U.S. policy centers whose work expands many progressive causes. And very promising, I think, was the 2011 launch of the American Dream movement and the new group that Van Jones has created, the Rebuild the Dream. In one of its first actions, the New Dream movement framed a contract for the American Dream, a platform that includes many progressive themes like jobs and clean energy and good schools and healthcare and so on. And now we have the developments launched originally by the Occupy Wall Street movement. And internationally, thanks to the work of Bill McKibben and 350.org and others around the world, the climate justice movement is taking shape. So a good start has been made, but much remains to be done. In politics, a big mistake has been made by many progressive groups, including the environmental community where I've been involved, and the miscalculation has been to neglect electoral politics. We have not been out there organizing at the grassroots, fielding candidates, building PACs, raising money for elections. And progressives have got to come together to build a mighty force in electoral politics. Third, in communities. Former House Speaker Tip O'Neill, of course, is famous for saying that all politics is local. And a progressive movement must stress building locally, from the bottom up. We all live local lives, and for people to become engaged politically, we've got to build at the local level. In the world, there are many reasons why we need, as a domestic movement, to have strong contacts with international organizations which are working for the same causes. And most importantly of those reasons is that there's a huge international agenda on which nationally based progressive communities must collaborate. We think of all, for example, the huge environmental issues we face at the international level. With knowledge, with conservatives seemingly disavowing good science at every turn, from climate science to evolution to stem cells to sexual orientation to energy research, it's doubly important that progressives embrace science and technology. Nothing against faith, of course, but the scientific content of public policy issues is increasing steadily, and progressives won't be leading in the right directions unless we embrace science and technology and the wonderful things that are happening in our academic communities rather than rejecting them. Relatedly, a progressive should encourage both appeals to moral values and kicking up a ruckus, but it also remains important to ground appeals and campaigns on solid analysis, accurate history, facts. They all go together well. As Stephen Colbert has reminded us, the facts have a well-known liberal bias. In the end, the most meaningful changes will almost certainly require a rebirth of marches and protests and demonstrations and direct action and nonviolent civil disobedience. Protests are important to dramatize issues, to show the depth of concern, to attract public and media attention, to build sympathetic support and raise public consciousness and put issues on the agenda. No one who's followed the recent events in Egypt or the Wisconsin State House or the tar sands protest, or who remember the civil rights and the anti-war protest of the 60s and the 70s, can doubt the importance of direct action. Finally, with history. There are historical trends that require the development of the movement that I am urging here. The widespread persistence of relative poverty at home and absolute poverty abroad, the emerging exhaustion of the planet's renewable and non-renewable resources, the impossibility of ongoing exponential growth on a finite planet, the destruction of the climate regime that has existed throughout human civilization, seemingly endless war that we're engaged in. These are among the many warnings that things cannot go on as they are. So, my friends, America the possible awaits us if we're prepared to struggle, to build this movement, to sacrifice, to put it all on the line. If the future is to be one that we wish for our grandchildren, we better get started building it now. And that building it, in my judgment, at this point has two essential initial features. Building the new America from the ground up in our communities and building true democracy and popular sovereignty in our country. Thank you.
Thank you, Gus Speth. This is the Monadnock Summer Lyceum, hosted by the Unitarian Universalist Church in Peterborough, New Hampshire, and broadcast on New Hampshire Public Radio. We have some time for questions from the audience. Will the ushers collect them? But let me begin by asking. In an email conversation with you, you told me that when you established the World Resources Institute, in 1982, you saw 10 environmental challenges, but only one has had real progress. Can you elaborate?
I don't want to do a Rick Perry here and forget some of my 10. But there are a whole series of major global scale environmental challenges. Climate change, deforestation, species loss, loss of ocean fisheries, and on and on. Freshwater shortages, excessive nitrogen presence, and others. And the list grows to 10. And the only one of those where we've really turned the corner and you can say, wow, maybe we're going to solve this problem, and are busily solving it, is ozone depletion. The Montreal Protocol, the international treaty that addresses the depletion of the ozone layer, has been successful. So far. On the others, I'm afraid the negative trends have continued, almost unabated. In some cases, temporary improvements, but it's an enormously distressing conclusion. And it's really the conclusion that started me back in the around 2002, a decade ago, on a search for why. Why was the environmental community, as we get stronger and more powerful, and we have more treaties, and we have more members, and we have more money, why are we still losing? Big time. Sure, there have been some improvements in air and water pollution in the U.S., which I could try to explain, on the biggest issues, and even on some of our core domestic issues, progress has been scant or to non-existent. So that was really what launched my personal search to try to understand the deeper forces that we were faced with. And you get, when you do that, you have told my family I've been sort of radicalized by reality. I mean, I'm not making this up. And so you have to deal with the reality. And now what we see is, it's not, when I started working on America the Possible, issues like inequality and poverty in our country were hardly discussed at all. And we have the Occupy movement in particular for having pushed these issues into the public discourse in an important way. So it's not just environment where we're having these, we're failing. It's environment, but we also see huge social issues that are festering in our country, unaddressed, and the political problems that I enumerated. And so, you've got to ask, okay, what's behind all this?
Picking up on that Tea Party reference, the two most visible and most potent democratic movements in the last 5 years have been, one, the rise of the Tea Party, and two, the Occupy movement, and yet they seem at odds with each other. How do you reconcile this with your thesis that we need democratic reform?
I wish I understood all that I would like to understand about the Tea Party, but I'll say a few things, and I might get it wrong. It seems to me that one thing the Tea Party demonstrates is that you can go from protest and anger to movement to power quickly in this country, if that is what you want to do. And you can build up enough people to go with you on that journey. And that should be very encouraging for progressives. A lot of the Occupy community are really disdainful of that trajectory in any short term, because they are so disdainful of politics and the possibilities of politics in our country right now. And they're trying to do another type of transformation, which is to transform people's understanding, to affect people's basic values and understanding. And they have, a lot of the Occupy forces are more in that mode than they are, let's move from protest to movement to power. Now, there was a book written by a man named David Sirota called The Uprising. It came out, shortly before. It was a book about the populist uprising in America. And he looked across the whole spectrum of discontent from, what was then at that point sort of proto-Tea Party people to people on the left. He predicted that a lot of good things were going to come together, and there was going to be, coming out of this, a populist progressive movement in the country. And what happened instead was that we got the Tea Party out of that, the main thing that happened, and then Occupy came in later. So it didn't come together. Is there still some potential for bringing a sort of Tea Party sentiment together with an Occupy sentiment? I think there's a lot of shared, certainly a lot of shared anger there. There's a lot of shared values, but in my judgment, I think one thing that happened to the Tea Party is that some operatives on the right, like Dick Armey, moved in and began to, mobilize these forces in certain directions, including a visceral attack on government and government spending and taxation and regulation and all of that. It sort of became part of the Republican Party, in my view, which it didn't have to do that. And somebody needs to, at least bring some segments of these communities together, in my view.
The strength of the voting process depends upon the literacy level of the voter. Yet 29% of the high school graduates, according to current research, are functionally illiterate. How do we address the growing levels of illiteracy in America, specifically How can we engage those who cannot read well enough to educate themselves about the deepest needs of American politics today?
Well, statistically, our educational system is now, as I mentioned, down at the bottom of the old OECD countries, and indeed, well below some of the leaders, which are now emerging places like Singapore. We have a severe educational deficit in the country at really all levels, from basic knowledge and skills to advanced skills. And we just need a huge investment in these areas beyond anything that we have contemplated in the past. And in the meanwhile, what are we doing? We're dismissing teachers all over the country. And I think we need a huge amount of federal and state and local spending on education to try to deal with these issues. In the meanwhile, people need to be part of organizationals. I mentioned the idea that we've lost a lot of the larger organizations that used to bring individual voters together, help them understand the issues and where they could be, what should be tried in Washington and promoted in Washington for groups of voters that share their values and their interests. We've lost a lot of those larger institutions, and in particular labor unions, which have now declined to the point where they're only about 7% of the private sector, I think, is unionized. This has not happened accidentally. We won't go into that, but I think the other thing that we need to do, in addition to education, is to build strength in these large membership organizations that can help bridge between the isolated individual voter and this very complicated national political process that we have.
These are all good grand ideas, but realistically, what are one or two that could be accomplished in my lifetime? I'm 70.
So am I. The great thing that everybody can participate in are these efforts that are ongoing in so many of our communities. I don't know, where you're all from, but I, when I go in Montpelier, Vermont, and I know it's a transition town. I know they've got a lot of things going. There's a lot of effort onto local food. There's a lot of Bali, the Business Alliance for Local Living Economies, is creating networks of rooted small businesses. All states are creating new incorporation laws for businesses which can keep the social mission front and center and not worry about shareholder priority. There's just so many exciting things going on across the country, and this is something that everybody can get involved in, because we're bringing the future into the present, into reality today, and seeing these things is believing that something better can be built. And I would think continuing these efforts, going to scale with them. I would love to see a more of a concerted effort on the part of the New England and Northeastern states to adopt what you can think of as a sort of full spectrum sustainability in the region and set the course for the country with things like single payer health care, which we're trying to get in Vermont, and other things.
In the event of a Republican presidential win this fall, is there any hope for climate change action on a national level?
Well, let's put it this way. It's going to be very hard to get a strong, effective government action if we have a Democrat-elected president, if President Obama is reelected. It's going to be hard, given the context, because we can't anticipate huge, vast turnover in the Congress, I don't think. Congress is now full of climate deniers, and with the current setup, they don't change the filibuster rule when they start the new Congress, which they can do. It's going to be very hard to get anything happen under the best of circumstances, is what I'm saying. And if Governor Romney is elected, and we have to take him at his word, he really is not interested in doing anything about the climate issue. And he's certainly supported by, huge numbers of people in politics and in campaign finance and elsewhere who really don't want to see this issue addressed. So I think the difference is probably, and unfortunately, the difference is between a continued modest effort if Obama wins, and an effort to perhaps to cut back dramatically on EPA's existing authorities if Governor Romney wins. So there's a sharp difference there. Don't mistake it at all if you're concerned about the climate issue. There's a very sharp difference. The sad thing is that, you know, in 4 years ago, we had Clinton and Obama campaigning on who could put forward the strongest climate action plan in the campaign. And even McCain had been sponsoring climate action legislation in the Senate. So we've fallen back way too far. I'm afraid it's going to take something like a crisis. Perhaps the whole center of our country drying out and burning up, which is, you know, we're seeing happening right now. And crop failures on a huge scale, sea level rise continuing. I mean, something's going to have to break this thing loose. I mean, I talked about big changes and you know, deep transformative changes and this kind of thing. But truth is, we're going to have to act on climate change long before we're able to build a new political economy in this country. We're going to have to act now. It's getting urgent. I sense this is changing, though. I sense these the global weirding, the developments in we're having in weather patterns already, the temperature records that have been broken, freak storms, the flooding, the drought, the sea level rise. I think it's waking people up now, and I think the climate issue is going to come back. But it's going to be hard, and people are going to have to organize in a major way. And I give Bill McKibben and 350.org, you know, real credit for being the group that's out there now taking this issue to the public in the way that I think it needs to be.
Thank you again, Gus Speth, for sharing your time and expertise with us today. You have been listening to the Monadnock Summer Lyceum on New Hampshire Public Radio. The Monadnock Summer Lyceum presents a weekly series of lectures held at the Unitarian Universalist Church in Peterborough, New Hampshire. For more information about the Lyceum, you can visit our website at www.monadnocklyceum.org or by writing the Monadnock Summer Lyceum, 25 Main Street, Peterborough, New Hampshire, 03458. The program next Sunday will feature poet Taylor Malley, who will speak about the greatest job in the world, teaching.